And today, friends, we have two very, very special guests with us in our Road Safety Edition. We have with us the founders of You Choose Youth Road Safety. You Choose Youth Road Safety. All the way from Australia, Mrs. Melissa McGuinness and Mr. Peter McGuinness, a husband and wife team. Now, a little bit about this brave power couple who started You Choose Youth Road Safety, known as Australia's youth-led mission to change driving culture. In 2012, Melissa and Peter McGuinness's 18-year-old son, Jordan, was speeding under the influence of alcohol and cannabis. He then collided with a stopped vehicle that had five other young adults. The result of that collision, the four members of the other car and Jordan himself deceased. A total of five young adults died that day, and families would never be the same again. Jordan's own family, his own parents, Melissa and Peter, were left in grief, guilt, shame, and shambles. They raised a good kid that made some terrible choices that changed the trajectory of so many lives. Melissa and Peter, though, were determined to not let this tragedy and this mistake their son did be for nothing. They have turned their grief into purpose and are now saving lives and other families. They are doing this through their non-for-profit, You Choose Youth Road Safety. And since 2017, You Choose Youth Safety had been facilitating Australia's youth-led mission to change driving culture. The program developed by Melissa and Peter McGuinness engages young people around Australia with highly relatable messages about love, family, and the empowerment of choice. You Choose Youth Road Safety is advocated by students, parents, educators, and police throughout Australia. And they collaborate with numerous international organizations, such as Students Against Destructive Decisions in the USA. Melissa and Peter, it is my honor to have you here with us.
Hi, good evening, Julia.
What a pleasure to speak with you, Julia, and thank you for the generosity of your description of us and your welcome. Thank you.
Oh yes, it's all heart with you guys. So Melissa and Peter, we went over the basics of your story and the life-saving purpose you have found from that. But for our listeners that don't know your story, as much as you are comfortable with sharing today, tell us a bit about your story as a parent and how you started, how you really started your organization, You Choose Youth Road Safety.
Well, Julia, back in 2017, I was invited by our local police to talk to 600 students about our backstory of what Jordan had done back in 2012. And, you know, as you said earlier, that evening he was driving home from his first ever work Christmas party. And he had been drinking. At some point he'd smoked marijuana, and he was speeding in excess of 30 kilometres of the speed limit when he hit a broken down stationary car on the side of our major highway here on the Gold Coast. And that car exploded into flames, killing four young adults, as you mentioned. So it took us a long time to get ourselves to a point where we felt like we were human enough to go and share our story. We knew that we had an important message that we could utilise through Jordan's choices that evening to inspire our teens to go out and make changes in their own community. So in 2017, I did join the police and I talked to those 600 students. I had no idea how we were going to respond or how those teens were going to respond with the story, but it was evident on that very first day just how much we were able to engage with those students and inspire what started the You Choose Youth Road Safety mission to change driving culture in Australia.
We very much thought from the outset, Julia, that we had something to teach through our lived experiences. And from that day to this, we do not seek sympathy for ourselves in any of this, of course. The sympathy belongs with Jordan's victims. We're determined to seek a change in attitudes and behaviours. But very interestingly, from the first time that we were invited to speak, and that Melissa did engage those 500 or 600 students, we very quickly learned that our purpose is very much to learn rather than to teach. And we've maintained that sense of curiosity from then until now, and we still maintain it.
Yes.
Because it's the verbatim feedback that we get about the connections between love and choice and outcomes that shape our messages to every student, right from those first ones until the 100,000-plus students that participate in our mission now.
And, you know, that is it's such serendipity how I met you guys, because that is why we always say in our organization that in matters of life and death, hindsight just isn't enough, you know? You know, 2020 vision, but in matters of death is so final. But Melissa, to the presentation, I loved in your presentation when you said, imagine it is your mother standing here. You know, like that resonated so much with me, you know, because I had great parents. I still have them, knock on wood. I have great parents, but I've made terrible mistakes. And I have friends who have great parents who have made terrible mistakes from being misguided, you know, trusting the wrong people, thinking I was invincible, you know. And I remember when I was in my like late 20s, my dad said to me, Julia, as you get older, your mistakes become more serious and more permanent, you know. And like that was like a bucket of cold water for me. But I say that to say that I know that you say, you know, the sympathy lies with the victims, which is true. And I agree with that. But there is empathy for you, too, because you didn't cause it. So you in yourself, in my view, are a victim, too. But, you know, I think that some mistakes are more public and some are more permanent. And some come from great families, you know, some come from good people who come from great families. And from good parents who just made terrible mistakes. So I just wanted to say that to you both today, because of what you said, Melissa, which is, think if this was my mother standing here and the empathy that I felt, you know, that, you know, wherever Jordan is, if he feels, I'm pretty sure he feels that too. So I just wanted you to know that from my point
of view. A very important part. And that's something that I say at the very early stages of the presentation, because I'm relatable as a mother. Jordan is relatable as a teen. Our family is relatable as your everyday family. And part of making those connections with those teens is to create that relatability. Yeah. So when I do stand up there very early on in the piece and I literally say to those students, I want you to imagine that it's not me standing up here today.
Right, right.
I want you to imagine that it's your mum or your dad or your loved one, and they're standing up here talking about you. So as we take them on this journey through the You Choose presentation, the first half is we sort of somewhat break them down through the choices that Jordan made, those very relatable choices. And then for the second part of the presentation, we really reinforce and we build those students back up. So as they're sitting there in the auditorium listening to our presentation, they're not thinking about me and Jordan and Jordan's siblings and Peter. They're actually thinking about it in context to their own loved ones.
Yes.
And that's why it's really, really important to make those connections about just imagine it's your mum.
Yes.
And you make a very astute point, Julia, about our instincts to sympathise.
Yes.
And it very much speaks to the subject of intent.
Yes.
Which is something we've learnt from young drivers themselves, not just in Australia, but all young drivers that we've engaged.
Yes.
In that we know that Jordan did not intend to kill anyone that night. Just like we know that it's not rational for us to carry his guilt and his culpability with us.
Yes.
However, these are visceral feelings.
Yes.
They're very deep-seated feelings that a teen, that anyone, that we talk to young people, any young driver or any young passenger with a poor choice could pass those feelings on to their loved ones unintentionally, but still really. So while we welcome and we accept the fact that people will empathise with our family.
Yes.
The fact of the matter is that part of the culture that we seek to change is the connection between excusing poor choices because we didn't have intent as a form of sympathy.
Yes.
So specifically what I'm saying is that the fact that Jordan didn't intend to kill anyone that night doesn't mean that what he did was an accident.
Right. I agree. But that's Jordan. So, you know, I was talking about you.
Reno? Yeah, yeah. So for us, we discuss this a lot, don't we, Melissa? And we experience this almost every day in what we do in the mission. There's a phrase that is used very frequently in Australia, and I'm sure it's the same in Canada and everywhere around the world, and that is, poor Jordan, we've all done it.
Oh, I see what you mean. So when we
let that phrase sit on us for a while, like we've all made mistakes. It's a very common thing to say, oh, poor Jordan, poor you, poor everyone that's involved in road trauma. We've all made mistakes.
Understood.
So, of course, the more we reinforce that natural empathy we've got for people that have undergone tragedy by saying we've all done it or we've all made mistakes, the more we tend to underline that cultural that misguided culture of bad luck, being bad driver. But bad luck, we've all done this, we've all made mistakes. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, what we try to uplift young people to is to take control of that and to say, you know what, you don't have to make these mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of mistake that falls into choice. You don't have to drive recklessly. You don't have to drink drive. You don't have to break the road rules and endanger other people on the road and put your own family at risk of this horrible grief. There's nothing compelling you to make those mistakes.
And
we seek to have young people empower each other.
Right.
You know, to uplift each other to good decisions rather than to give each other excuses for these kind of lethal mistakes.
Right. And actually, there's so many things about your organization and your mission that resonated deeply with me and my company. But the whole notion of empowering people to make an informed decision, that one, and changing the culture of driving, that's number two. Yeah, both of those. Those two resonated with me, where I said, you know, no, I have to reach out to her, and you know, reach out to her. I saw her pop up on my LinkedIn. I said, oh wow, let me see you read. And I was reading more. I said, oh wow. And then
we're not that far apart, are we, Julia?
No,
it's a small world. We've got many similar community stakeholdings together, haven't we?
Yeah. So with us, what we are doing is normalizing the use of breathalyzers, as we said before, we spoke before about this in our society, you know, smart proactive tools, because you know, we want people to gauge how much time they need to have passed, because time is the only thing that can, you know, get you sober enough to drive. The thing is, I know a lot of times you hear people say, oh, you know, people shouldn't drink and drive, and or in the same afternoon they shouldn't drink and then drive and say nothing. But in reality, we have to meet people where they are. And I mean, the fact of the matter is, sporting events have parking lots and they have alcohol. Wineries, restaurants, breweries, they all have parking lots, not just for the employees, but you know, everybody is trying to be conscious. And luckily enough, the breweries and the wineries up here, they've been like really good and really open and really accepting to, you know, doing that extra step, you know, having people get the breathalyzers. So it's the fact that alcohol isn't going anywhere, you know, and we have a culture of having a drink while we're out. So the fact that it's not going anywhere, you know, we have to meet people there and we have to show them how they can be smarter about how they live with it. So either you call a car or you take a taxi, but if you go there and say, if you have a designated driver, don't, and I'll tell you this one story. This young girl said to me, oh, you know, I had just one glass of whiskey. I was there for 3 hours. And when I got home, I, you know, blew 0.06. I said, when did you have the glass of whiskey? She said, I downed it and then I went in the car. How long did it take you to get home? 30 minutes. Well, of course. It's, you know, it takes 20 minutes. Your body has to metabolize the alcohol. You can't just drink and then leave. You can't do that. You have to wait. You have to wait until it comes out of your system. Eat food, drink water, you know. So a lot of people don't know these things. They just think that they could just have coffee or wind their window down and they'll be, that will sober them up. But no, time is the only thing. So we want people to
attitude of, yeah, she'll be right. It's, I've just had one or I've just had two. It's inside my, you know, 2 hour time frame.
Right.
It'll be all right. I'll self-analyze,
you right, know,
what right, I think my driving skills and blood alcohol level might be.
Right. So,
and particularly in our case, Julia,
mm-hmm,
our provisional licensing system in Australia,
yes,
has a zero blood alcohol limit attached to newly licensed drivers for,
is it 3 years?
For 3 years.
Yeah.
So between ages 17 and a half, usually around about there,
17. Well, 17, you can get your license at 17.
17 through to around 20, you're obliged to have a blood alcohol limit of zero. So after you, and this is where our legislative framework can be somewhat misaligned, because you can be licensed, you get licensed to drive a year before it is legal for you to buy and consume alcohol, but then your blood alcohol level must be zero,
yeah,
for another 18 months to 2 years after you, it has become legal for you to drink.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got somewhat of a legislative misalignment between our licensing and legislative frameworks, you know, with driving on one hand and drinking on the other. And part of what we do is to, you know, lobby our various state and regional governments to align those policies together a little bit more effectively.
Because I think, yeah, also on that, we have in Australia, you can get your license at 17. But if you choose to drink, you have a crash, you cause a fatality and you're, yeah, breaking all the laws, you're not going to go to prison because you're under our statutory age of 18. So we've got, right, 1 year of kids with provisional licenses where they're not treated as an adult through the court system, yet they could essentially drink alcohol, drive, kill someone as a result. It happens all the time. We meet, yeah, families where this is exactly what's played out.
Mm-hmm.
But that person that committed the crime previous to being 18 is not treated how they would be had they been 18. So we've got that slight disconnect as well.
So once again, tools.
Yeah.
Tools such as what you do and resources such as you have, Julia, are so valuable as part of that whole mix of policy responses.
Right. As I said before, like France now, they have drivers driving around with those breath kits, breathalyzers, car kits, because, and if they don't, they can be ticketed. So that is something great that France put in. And Europe is always ahead of the curve sometimes with this.
Yeah.
But what are some of the misconceptions you run into? Like I said before, mine are, you know, I didn't know the speed limit in Ontario is 0.05, or another one is I'll wind up my window and that will sober me up. What are some of the misconceptions you run into?
Oh, our big one, very similar to yours when it comes to drink driving, Julia, but the two very, very impactful, misguided paradigms that we work on culturally here are the two biggest ones are, firstly, that I can smoke weed, I can take various other substances which impair my judgment and my reflexes and everything else. But it's all okay because I'm under the blood alcohol limit.
Right.
So we have a generation of kids that have been fairly effectively pitched to by many decades of campaigning against drink driving, and they don't. They fall into the traps that you described about self-analysis and all that. But at the end of the day, we find that the other impairment substances are exploding in their impact in our society, and in particular, the ubiquitous use of weed. So drug driving is definitely it's seen as being soft, or seen as being non-impactful, and we all know that that's not the case. The other thing is, and I think we have parallels in this, we've got big differences between attitudes to impaired driving in the cities and in the regional areas. And I believe this is very similar in Canada, and I'm interested in your thoughts here, Julia, but outside of the cities in Australia, and we're very urbanised here, but in the regions, there are no public transport options for most kids. There certainly aren't car services like Uber, and they're left with driving everywhere for all purposes. Their whole social lives are spent going from A to B in their vehicles, and sometimes they're relatively long distances.
And generally with five kids in the car.
And
yeah, they're traveling packs. Yeah.
And also, unlike in the urban areas, they're driving on single lane carriageways out in the countryside with high speed limits. So you've got this mix of very sparse policing, high-speed, single-lane carriageway roads, so the roads are far less safe in the regional areas than what they are in the metropolitan areas, and a social framework, which is a very drinking-oriented social framework, with no transport, public transport infrastructure. So our road trauma statistics in our regional and country areas are significantly worse than what they are in the metro areas because of that.
That's just compounding the problem. You know, there are some disconnects there. But
you know, Julia, it's interesting for me being in this position that Peter and I are all about. Yeah. Road safety and, you know, definitely choices. I myself, or both of us, we will never ever have an alcoholic beverage if we are going to drive. Never. It's not even an option. And often I'll go out with some of my friends and I'll be in a position where I don't really like to tell adults what to do, but we might be with a friend having dinner and that friend will have a few drinks and then she will say, "Rightio, I'm going to drive home," and I have to have this to take this position to go, well, actually, you have no idea what your blood alcohol
level. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I do it all the time.
And the last thing I'm going to allow under my watch is for my friend to drive home, and then I find out the next day that the friend that I just had dinner with has killed herself or someone else on those roads. So I always take that stance that no,
you don't know.
You leave your car.
That's why I carry them for my friends. Oh, they love it. They love it.
I'm surprised every person does not have one on them. 100%
We would be very much in favour of not just having a breathalyzer resources, personal breathalyzer resources for offenders as part of their rehabilitation, programs or directives. But for every driver.
Of course, because it's not a punishment. It's not a punishment. And
it's not a punishment at all.
Paul, that's one of the, sorry, Peter, sorry. That's one of the, one of the problems, what I see, you know, when I speak to people, especially that demographic 55 or so, they would say, well, you know, you get the kind of sense like you did something wrong. You had a DUI, now you are punished. Here's a breathalyzer in the car, right?
Yes.
And that's how it was introduced to society. And I'm like, it is a smart, proactive safety tool. And then I have to remind myself, Julia, they gave seatbelts a fight. They really did give seatbelts a fight. You read about it. So, you know.
Julia, you make such a good point about that. You make such a great point, and it's the same in Australia.
Yeah.
About the gender. This is why we aim our culture change project
right
at 16 to 19 year olds, because it's too late to change right. our attitudes and behaviors for even 25 year olds, let alone 50 year olds. There is a sense, an entrenched sense of entitlement to break the law. So everything that you do to try and save people's lives is perceived as being an infringement on their right to break the law and endanger other people on public roads. It's quite a bizarre dynamic. I'm sure this is the case in Canada, but I note with interest that, you know, there's an immense pushback in the US on speed cameras and so on. We have speed cameras
In
Australia.
Yeah.
They're very effective. But, you know, Facebook groups, social media groups have sprung up all over Australia where people share information about where speed cameras are.
Yeah.
Now, they posture.
Well, sometimes booze buses
as well. And booze buses or our random breath testing units. Now, they posture these social media sites and these online communities as somehow being attached to road safety, which of course is complete nonsense. Yeah. What they are is that they are devices, social devices, so that people can continue to break the law. So how do we change this mindset? That's one example. Another example, and we challenge parent groups and PNCs about this all the time. You know, you've got your kids are in your lounge room with you, and you receive your infringement notice, you know, for speeding or whatever it is in the mail, and you pick that notice up and you go, "Those bloody cops, they've entrapped me again with this speeding fine. How dare they? They always put those speed traps, or they always put those cameras, or the police are always waiting in those areas that they're entrapping me." What we don't do is we don't receive that infringement notice and think, okay, we've been busted doing, you know, 15 kilometres an hour over the speed limit. That's just when I've been busted. What are my driving habits when I'm not busted?
Yeah.
We have a reflexive sense of entitlement that road rules are not the law of the land, that are there to protect people's lives. The road rules are there to somehow inhibit us from our right to endanger other people on the road. That's an entrenched attitude that we've had for 100 years in Australia. All of these other fantastic changes have happened to impact road safety. We've never had safer roads. Obviously, we've never had safer motor vehicles. There's never been as much public and governmental investment in driver education, traditional skills education. Never been more stringent penalties and regulations. And yet, our road trauma statistics in Australia have been stubbornly static for going on three decades. The needle has hardly moved from that time in the 70s and the 80s, like you shared in Canada and elsewhere in North America, where seatbelts became mandatory,
right,
where blood alcohol limits became mandatory, and the road toll went down enormously. In Australia, it decreased by many, many thousands. But it almost hasn't shifted since then. So we contend that the missing component, the thing that hasn't changed, is that attitude of entitlement to break the law. Our driving culture hasn't changed. Engineering has changed. Laws have changed. Cars have changed. Driver ed and skills programs have changed. Why are our statistics not moving? Why are 16 to 25-year-olds actually increasing they're already overrepresentation in road trauma statistics? And I know that's the same in North America as well. There are many reasons. You know, we've got devices in cars now, which cause all sorts of mayhem. But we look at it from a behavioural standpoint and think, for all of the things that have changed over 50 or 60 years that have made us safer on the roads, why is the statistics not continuing to be driven down, and what hasn't changed? And, you know, we come back to it every day, don't we? What hasn't changed is our shared, our collective attitude to driving culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, well, to be honest, people here, they're pretty conscious. Like I said, like the breweries and the wineries, you know, when you, so, of course, you're going to get resistance. sometimes. Of course you are. You know, everybody won't be a yes. But people here try to be really conscious about the drinking and driving, or try to be conscious about being caught drinking and driving, you know, because, you know, so.
Actually, I'm curious, Julia. Mm-hmm. We've got, we've certainly had an improved, I'd call it an occupational health and safety culture.
Yes.
So our corporate culture,
right,
has definitely shifted in line with the law, and obviously with you know, an increased litigiousness.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, businesses will no longer have the Christmas party where everyone boozes up and leaves. You know, like you say, bars, wineries, breweries, and so on, you know, have, you know, much tighter policies about serving, you know, intoxicated
people. We still have them. We still have them.
There's certainly much,
but it's just a part of the culture. And the thing is, as I said, alcohol isn't going anywhere. So we have to learn to live with it smart. So that's funny that you brought it up, because another part of our business, which is our service part of it, what we do is we go to events, like corporate events, where alcohol is served, and we make the high quality breath testing equipment available. So no one leaves above the limit or, you know, near the limit.
Yeah.
And say, we could also arrange, say if someone wants to stay and enjoy the bar, you know, we arrange for them to get a ride home, you know, with, well, I won't mention the company now, but in certain places. But so that's what we do. And the thing is, it helps them, protects their, it helps them with liability. And also it protects, you know, the users of the roads, it protects their patrons, protects their employees, probably protect them too, protect everybody on the road. And because we all want the same thing. Like the people in the hospitality industry here, they're very hardworking. And the thing is, they want to have a great event, and we want the same things. You know, we want people to, like we always say, live life to the full. We want people to enjoy themselves, but we want people to do so. We believe that the best way to do that is to do so safely, right? Mm-hmm. Where you protect yourself and you don't get careless. That's not truly enjoying. That's just losing control, you know? So
Julia, I've got a question for you, and I'm so curious, because I don't know why in Australia breathalyzers aren't a really big part of our culture, and I hope that changes, and we will definitely be advocating for that. But when you're at those events and you say to someone, here's a breathalyzer, test yourself, how often does that person go, oh no, I should be right?
And no, not like that. You see, when we go to the events, we actually have a machine. So it's like an industrial strength is really strong and very accurate. So we stand there and we have our booth. So we may have some breathalyzers, some single use ones for sale too, but people are naturally curious, and we are in hospitality. We make people feel comfortable. We talk to people, people come up, they're like, oh, what are you doing? What are you doing here? I said, oh, we're giving breakfast. It's free for that. You want to see where you are? When was your last drink? You know, we ask them and we educate them that, hey, you wait 20 minutes after your last drink and after your last bite to eat, because sometimes the cakes have alcohol too. So you don't need any breath alcohol going into the machine. And you want to also get a true reading. You want to wait until it metabolizes, right? So we talk to people, and the thing is, people don't wear their hurt on their sleeve. But one out of three people would have some story that they were affected by alcohol, them or somebody in their family, about drinking while driving or something like that. And they'll say, thanks for being here, or, you know, so we're pretty well received, and we're friendly people. That's our brand. You know, we love people. And our soft skills are, you know, very, very important, because you have to be, as I said, you have to be able to meet people where they are. You can't demonize people. And expect them to listen to you. You have to, and the fact is, we're not hypocrites, because we are young and we go out, and you know what I mean? But we do so safely, right?
So we want people not about to be shaming empowered. Them, but uplifting them to those great. It's not about shaming them, it's about uplifting them to great choices. But what I was curious about, how many people that test themselves on your industrial breathalyzer think that beforehand that they should be
all the time.
The price to go,
all the time. Okay, I'll tell you, one was, no, I'm fine. I'm 0.07, see, I'm fine. Yeah, but in Ontario, it's 0.05. What? They cut it down?
Reason I asked that question is way back when, probably 15 years ago, it was the culture inside a particular company that I worked with that on a Friday afternoon, you'd have a couple of drinks, sign off for the week, and then you'd get in your car and drive. Mm-hmm. For my entire driving life, I've never been breathalyzed
mm-hmm.
after having a drink. So for me, I would have no idea, and I'm a reasonably small person, I would have no idea what my body metabolizes alcohol. Yeah. So I could have my two drinks, be under that that limit and think, no, I'm fine, which is what I would have done 15 years ago, thinking, no, it's been...
There are a lot of factors that can affect it. First of all, have you eaten? What did you eat? Hydration. The time, how fast you drank your drink, the time between the drinks, all of that factors in. So...
Because I was always so curious to go, could somebody breathalyze me? So I've got some sort of idea, which is why I just use... never to drink ever under those circumstances for that exact reason. I don't know, and I'm not going to risk it.
We just love your logic, Julia, that says everyone at a bar has turned themselves into a biological clinician that understands their own scientific metabolism to this nth degree, where you can judge your own blood alcohol limit. Like when you put it like that, it is pretty absurd. So the idea of the personal breathalyzer is just something that it would be great to see, as you so correctly point out, and it's opened our eyes to that dynamic that says this is not a punishment. This is actually something that's really great.
It's a gift.
It's not inhibiting you at all. It's actually setting you.
Anything that's making you more informed about what state you're in, and it's not hurting somebody else, how is that bad for you? We just need to allow people to see it. And I mean, people see it. Like now, slowly, our following has been growing. People have been writing, and let me tell you, sometimes it gets rough, because sometimes you wonder if it's gonna happen in your lifetime, but then you get a note that says, thanks, we thought we were okay to drive, but we didn't want to risk being pulled over with that brack, and I'm thinking, they think it's so light, but in my heart it's so deep,
I see that you've got that passion for service in your heart, Julia. So from what it's worth coming from us, like, bless you, having that resilience and that determination that you've got. Like, we see it every day when we're interacting with young people, every day.
Yeah.
That it's not so much, it's almost like two parts to this challenge.
Yeah.
You're quite right. Of course, alcohol, we're obviously never going back to prohibition. There's always going to be alcohol. So, how do we deal with the drinking culture that we've got, even separate to the driving culture that we've got? Would a personal breathalyzer have prevented our son from making the decisions that he made on that night? Probably not, because he was, totally self-aware in terms of what he was doing and chose to do it anyway. But where I see that the personal breathalyzer being so valuable, particularly in the age cohort that we interact with, is that that age group that we referenced before, where they're coming to the end of their provisional license, which means that they can have alcohol in their system once they get their open license, and it's become legal for them at 18 to be able to obtain alcohol and consume alcohol.
And drive,
right?
Yep.
So they're so at risk at that little window, because they're so frequently the designated driver in their friendship cohort. So it's the older person in that friendship cohort that's the first person, and they might otherwise be really responsible people. It's not like we're talking about some determined law-breaking maverick. It's a well-intentioned person that's actually got an appetite to do the right thing, but doesn't have the tools to do it properly.
Right.
You know,
Yeah,
there's a way you could say just don't drink at all, and that's a valuable sort of thing to say as well. But the reality is, what other resources can they have to make sure that they're protecting themselves, their friends, their families from all of this? We don't do it effectively here, and that's why we're so curious about, you know, what you do. And I think it's an important resource, an important discussion for us to have.
Thank you.
Yes. I mean, we would take the standpoint that you just do not ever drink if you drive.
Yes.
But we know for a fact there are going to be people that say, yes, that's great, but I'm still
going to do it. Exactly.
It's that person, it's that designated driver.
Yes.
And I'm labouring the point, but it's just, it's really stimulating to consider, because it's actually not the person that is determinedly making a selfish bad choice.
Right.
It's a whole set of different circumstances. It's that person that's intending to do something good.
Yes.
I'll be the designated driver. I'm the oldest one in our friendship cohort. Now, that might be the same person who has, driven the cohort to the event, to the party, to the sporting game, to the whatever, and the same person driving home. As you said before, Julia, that person might have had one drink, but when did they have it?
Right.
How did all the other physiology work around it?
Right. And it teaches people.
And these are the first few months that they've ever been able to drive with 0.05 alcohol in their system. So they've got no frame of reference to even judge.
Exactly.
Because I think you're allowed to have, one glass of wine or whatever they're drinking, but what does their glass look like?
Right.
Yeah. And what does their glass look like? A 200 mil filled to the top glass of...
Right. One standard drink. So, and it teaches people too, it teaches you about yourself. It lets you know that, well, I had this one, I had a 9-ounce glass of wine 45 minutes ago. It's saying that I'm 0.06. Maybe I should wait. Oh, this is what it feels like. It teaches people to be aware. So they know that, if I'm going to be here for 4 hours, I can have that one glass of wine early on. And by the time I'm ready to leave, I check my breathalyzer again. Yep, I'm fine. Good. You see,
I'm so pleased that you are sending us a breathalyzer, because I'm going to be that person at the party that goes around at the end of the night going, before you walk out the door, this is my responsibility. I love you so much. Try this. That is precisely what I'm going to do. So all of those friends that will say to me, no, I should be fine, it's been 2 hours or whatever. Yeah. Try this. Let's see. I'm going to be that person.
And let me know. Yeah. Let me know how I go. Take pictures.
I'll probably won't get invited.
And all the instructions are on the back. Pretty easy to follow.
And
so you really like it. Yeah.
Our frame, our context too.
Yes.
We've learned this through our own personal journey. Now, our context is not, we care about you not being punished by the law, or we care about you not getting busted.
Exactly.
Yeah, our context is, we care about you not killing someone.
Yeah, or killing.
I was going to say that before.
So it's an interesting dynamic at play.
It's exactly what I was thinking before. Yeah. When you're talking to those people at those venues, it's not about them getting in the car and killing themselves. It's about them getting in the car. What are they going to do? Whose innocent kid is going to be sitting in a car, or mother or father? It's not about you. Sometimes it's about every other person on that road. Is a shared responsibility, not about you.
But you know what, this is how I see it. Regardless of what the motivator is, once they don't do it, because I've had some people that think, if I have a DUI, I will never be able to work in my job again, or if I have a DUI, this time they're going to take my car away, and how am I going to get to work? That's what their motivator is. So be it. If that's your motivator to not do it, once you don't do it, I'm not saying that that's the right motive, it should be about, killing. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of people, they don't, they still think that things are 2 arms length away from them until it happens to them. They don't think that this will ever happen to me, or this will ever happen, it will happen to you, or, that's what they think. But whatever the motivator is for them to not do it, I'm fine with that.
There's a particular phrase that I say to every teen at every single presentation. And I do my best not to sound like I'm lecturing the teens, because I never want to lecture anyone. I want to inspire them and uplift them into good choices. But I talk about drink and drug driving, and I say the biggest problem with drink and drug use is that it removes your ability to make sensible choices. And this is in general, and definitely behind the wheel of the car, because the sober you would never allow the drunk or the drugged you to drive. Sadly, the drunk or the drugged you would. Once you start drinking, you lose that ability to make those sensible choices, which is, again, why having a breathalyzer helps you, helps to re-educate you in that moment that matters.
Exactly. And that's why the empowerment part of what you do, and letting them know, listen, it's your choice. You have a choice, right? That really, really, really resonated with me.
For our younger drivers, this is not something that would affect the older people or the adult people on their open licenses, but for the younger drivers, they have to be zero.
Correct.
They must be zero. So.
In Canada, we kind of
don't think our way through it. If we had personal breathalyzers available as part of the, as not a punitive device, but as a tool, to
a
assist,
life-saving tool.
Again, you know, from that educational standpoint, it's like this is the tiny amount of alcohol that you need to consume to move the dial on the breathalyzer. It's almost nothing. Don't think you can do it at all and remain at zero. It doesn't happen. It doesn't work like that. And here's proof.
There's
mechanisms to use these resources that aren't obvious, even for people that aren't legally allowed to consume alcohol, aren't legally allowed to have a blood alcohol limit at all. You know, they do it. What is a full suite of resources to demonstrate, the seriousness of impairment and impact, I think this kind of thing is a part of it.
You've also got that situation where you've got a teen that is 18, they've had their license, they go to a party, they drink the night before and they do the right thing, they cab it home or they Uber it home, and how do they know the next day, is it going to be 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock? How do they know that that alcohol has 100% lost, left there?
Very, very good.
It's almost like if you're a teen and you have your license and you're a teen that drinks at some stage, a responsible teen that does the right thing, how do you know exactly that when you get in the car the next time that your blood alcohol is zero? And the answer is you don't know unless you've left, 24 hours or 100%. Something.
We see this a lot. We've got a very well-intentioned advertising campaigns that have been rolling, out for 30 and 40 years, and I'm sure you'd be familiar with them, yourself in Canada. You've got very similar versions. They use humour to create relatability in anti-drug campaigns,
Hilarious.
Which is really hilarious until, tragedy actually does strike you. They become a little bit less humorous. But we've had a campaign that's rolled through here for ages, and I think it's a good message. It's an effective message, and it's about using your friend's couch or sofa.
Right.
And they talk about your, we call our buddies mates. It's your mate's motel, right? So stay at the mate's motel, right? Which is like stay on your mate's sofa, And there's funny images of people with dogs sleeping beside them, and right? You're staying with your mate. Don't drive home. Great message. Of course, in the reality of life, once again, it's okay. That's only part of a solution. So if it's 2:30 a.m. and you've consumed your massive amount of alcohol that you drink, you've done the right thing. You've stayed at your friend's place. Well, it might be 2 p.m. the next day before you're in any shape whatsoever.
That's very true. Right?
6 p.m. So, I mean, once again, if these devices were considered to be a normal tool of driving, like anything that you'd have.
Or anything, the motorized vehicle.
Like anything you'd have in your glove compartment, it would be a really, really positive addition to the suite of road safety.
Mandatory. That's what I'm working for. And it's catching on. It's catching on. And I see it. And because it's common, I have faith in it because it's common sense. And I know people.
Yes.
I mean, I know people here, they're open-minded and people are smart. I don't underestimate people. Yeah, and people can see the value in it. So
yeah. And for us, the reason we see the value too, Julia, and we admire and commend what you do, is that a lot of public policy in your country and ours is calibrated towards the determined lawbreaker.
Yeah,
like that person that I spoke to before about that person that says, I've got an entitlement to do whatever I want. But we don't often calibrate our support and our frameworks around that person who actually isn't a determined lawbreaker.
Yeah, my friend at dinner the other night.
That seeks to do the right thing, that person that is the designated driver, the person that is the person who uses the couch, the person that seeks to do the right thing, but needs every tool available to do it.
Yes.
So interesting. We could talk about it all day, couldn't we?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But you know what? The beauty and the curse of it is that we will never know the amount of people that we actually impacted in change of events or, what we stopped from happening that would have, led to tragedy. We'll never know. And that's a beauty, I guess, and a curse. In a lot of ways, we just have to have faith and just keep going one step at a time. I mean, even the fact that we met, it's so refreshing. That should be, we have to see the light for what it is,
Oh, for sure. There's definitely an optimism. We're very fortunate. And you are obviously too. You've mixed with a lot of young people.
Yes.
We're really blessed to be able to interact with so many teens and late teenagers.
Yeah.
And in your country and ours, it's easy for older people to look at this age cohort and go, wow, what an entitled generation they are, But the other side of that same coin of entitlement is empowerment.
Yeah.
They really can and truly believe and they really can change the world around them, and they've got such an appetite to do it.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
in a way that just uplifts us every day. It inspires us every day to keep doing what we do. And once again, I think there's some really creative ways that we could make use of specifically the products that you make available.
Thanks. And I definitely believe that we could have you here at some talks here in Canada. I think that would be awesome if we would love
to do that.
You know,
we never stop learning, Julia.
Right.
And the more we reach out into various other demographics, other cultures, other youth cohorts,
other countries,
the more we're struck by how
you like it here, and people they'll welcome you with open arms.
The more we're struck by the similarities that people who have the same sense of mission, around a heart for saving lives and a heart for service, and a heart, especially to uplift young people to great decisions. There's a real optimism to it.
Yeah. You have to believe in a future to do that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You can't be indifferent.
I know that this sounds like we're interviewing you, but I'm really interested in your perspectives on this, Julia.
Yeah.
What represents best practice in terms of those, the breathalyzing technology that is either ignition blockers or
you mean the interlocks?
Yeah, the interlocks.
Yeah, we have had some voluntary ones too. Best practices is, well, it depends on the interlock, but you must get it serviced. You don't try to remove it yourself because it could actually damage your car. You must have a licensed professional that knows interlocks, put it in and take it out. Have it serviced when you're supposed to. Follow the instructions. As usual, you wait at least 20 minutes after your last drink. So there's some interesting, I can't talk too much about it because there's some patent things going on now. But But yes,
I guess the reason
we have an interest. It is a good thing, and
the reason we have an interest. Sorry.
No. I think that it's really great for parents with young drivers and people who share a family car as well, because
yes,
you know, a lot of the young drivers, they want, I actually have an ad that says that, give them the freedom they crave, the protection that they deserve, because yes, they want to go out with their friends, they want to go here and there, and they don't want to be cooped up. So you say, okay, well, you can go, but knowing that they can't start the car without having a clean breath test there.
And to me, I love that. I love
other,
that
other parents would feel better too, letting them go with that, right? So that, and yes, that is something that I'm very interested in, very much so.
I love the positive proposition that you attach to it.
Yes.
Like that this actually provides you with the freedom. You may otherwise have parents that are, you know, are more inclined to ground you or not share the family car or to be too nervous to be able to do it. If you've got this device, it actually increases your freedom, not decreases it.
Right, exactly.
I love the truth behind that proposition, which is why I asked you the question, because
that's what we're doing. And we made some of those voluntary interlocks available already, and people actually love it.
So we get asked very frequently about the use of interlock technology in what we do. For example, like just recently, we've cooperated or shared information with the Royal Australian College of Surgeons, their trauma committee, you know, and obviously this group of people are, you know, well and truly you know, sick of putting teenagers back together, you know, from preventable road crashes
or popping them in a morgue.
Yeah, and you know, very, you know, keen on supporting and advocating the work that we do.
Yeah,
and we've discussed the idea of mandatory interlocking, you know, technology for provisional licensed drivers.
Yeah,
and of course, you know, there's civil liberties aspects to it. How are we curtailing people's freedom? You know, but it's a really positive and constructive narrative and discussion to have publicly, because it speaks to that issue that we touched on about half an hour ago, Julia, which is that entitlement to break the law. In other words, if you were resistant to having the interlock technology in your vehicle as standard equipment, why? Why?
Because the
answer to that very simple question is a very challenging one for us culturally, which again comes back to the entitlement culture. Why would you be
adverse,
resistant
yes.
to having that technology in every vehicle? Why? Is it because you feel an entitlement to break the law? Why are you resistant to standard road rules like speed limits? Why? Is it because of your sense of entitlement to endanger other people on public roads? I think it's interesting, in particularly in the Western countries that have got those traditions of frontierism and individualism. You know, Canada has it, the US definitely has it, Australia most certainly has it, where there's that ingrained sense that we're out to challenge and distrust the law, you know? And I think that would be part of what the resistance would be to just mandatory interlocking devices in Australia. But I'd love to expand on that public discussion and that public conversation in our culture, at least, because I think that, boy, we would really move the dial on our road trauma statistics if that technology was simply in every vehicle.
We should explore it then.
We really should. And it's a discussion we're not having in Australia. We just do not have that discussion. And the reason is because the technology, as no news to you, and you pointed it out, and it was really revealing to us, wasn't it, Melissa?
Yep.
That the perception of that technology is that it is a punishment.
Right. Yeah.
And it's not true. It's just not.
It's not true. It doesn't. But the perception is, and that was just how it was introduced. So that's when I realized, and it took a lot of research and talking to different people to really get that truth out. you know?
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of information in a no. That's the one thing that I learned in business. There's a lot of information. If you really dissect and just keep asking and keep listening, you'll find out what it is. And then if you ask that and they say, yes, that's exactly what it is.
You know what struck me as very unusual, and I haven't thought about this before, but Peter and I are in road safety. Our whole life is about road safety. I do not know one person who owns a breathalyzing unit. I know they're available in Australia, but it's so not on our radar.
Yeah,
I do not know one person.
Yes, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
It's disgraceful.
It's a different...
It's because they're considered to be punitive tools of punishment. Mm-hmm. Not freedom. I love what Julia just referenced with regard to teens. And here's where we can make the difference. It is way too late to have a sensible discussion about this to people who are over 25.
Yeah.
Right? Because they'll just be too entrenched with their ideas. And I'm including us in this, right? I'm talking about the whole cohort. The paradigm is that bad driving is bad luck. If you didn't intend to cause harm, but your choices do cause harm, there's still an accident. And that we're entitled to break the law. Now, those three things are an ingrained part of driving culture, certainly in our country, and I'm pretty sure the same applies to a lot of Western countries. And where, you know, we seek to uplift and empower young people to challenge those paradigms. What a tool to have to normalize the technology, the interlock technology in vehicles. No one under 25 would think that they were being somehow discriminated against or having their civil liberties curtailed by being prevented from lighting a cigarette up in a restaurant.
Yes, I remember that.
Like, it's a standard procedure, right? It's like you wouldn't dream of, no one's telling you not to smoke, just not here.
Right.
No one's telling you not to drink. Go ahead and drink.
Right.
You just can't drive if you do.
Right.
Or you just can't drive, or you just can't drink past this particular point and then start this car and drive it. You cannot do that. Why would you challenge that? There is no logic to challenging that other than to say, I feel I am entitled to break the law.
My brain is going a million miles an hour here, and I'm straight away thinking, when I have a girlfriend that's having a baby, my go-to gift to them is one of those electronic expensive thermometers. It's an expensive gift that you can't buy or that you don't generally buy for yourself. It's a fantastic gift. I'm going to make it a rule that every time I buy a present for one of my young nieces, nephews, my friends' kids that are coming to that age, my 18th gift or my 17th gift is going to be a breathalyzer.
What a great idea.
But that should be a campaign that for your kid for their 18th birthday, don't worry about all these other things we give them.
Yeah.
Give them happy birthday. Here's a breathalyzer. I love you.
And I will give you a birthday discount.
You're amazing.
Thank you. I know.
You are amazing. That's why we pay into medium-sized money.
I'm going to recommend it to every parent I come across, like I did with mothers having babies. Get them that thermometer. They'll love it. Every parent for their 18th birthday or 17th, breathalyzer. I'm going to run with that, Julia.
What? That would be great, because you know what? That is changing the culture itself. And it would be such an unusual gift at first. They'd be like, what? Oh, wow. This is so cool. You know?
It's and not punishment. Just go use it.
Yeah. It's a gift of love. It's a gift of going, I want you to be here and I don't want you to end up in prison. I love you.
Yes.
Here you go.
Yes, yes, yes. But we do have some testimonials here that I would like to share of your organization, if I may. That's okay. Some quotes, just to familiarize my audience more about, you know, the traction that you're leaving. So St. Patrick's College communication team says, it takes tremendous courage to turn a gut-wrenching tragedy into a powerful message of love, family, and empowerment of choice. But that's exactly what Melissa McGinnis managed to do through her presentation, You Choose, Youth Road Safety. Yesterday, our staff and senior students were privileged to hear Melissa's story about the loss of her 18-year-old son, Jordan, who died in a car crash in 2012, an accident which also claimed the lives of four other innocent young people. Through her presentation, Melissa challenged our students to consider how their decision-making has the potential to profoundly affect the lives of so many. Her organization's motto, "Own the Choice, Own the Outcome," really says it all. And we thank Melissa and her husband, Peter, for continuing to spread this message to as many young people as possible. And that was from St. Patrick's College communication team. And there's one more from a mother. Her name is Miss Samantha Corso. And she says, "Thank you for sharing your message at St. Patrick's College today. My son shared your story with me and said many students were moved by it. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for sharing your message at St. Patrick's College. And thank you for sharing your story." That is Samantha Corso.
We receive, you know, many hundreds of testimonials, you know, to go with the hard survey data that we collect, obviously, but it's uncanny how many parents, Julia, will contact us, and this happens every week, doesn't it, Melissa?
Yeah.
Where they'll say, you know, little Johnny, you know, my son, you know, went to a road safety presentation today at school, and of course, you know, he's expecting this boring sort of, you know, discourse about statistics and lectures about right and wrong and prescriptive behaviours and so on. He's come home and told me how much he loves me, and he's given me a big hug. You know, what have you done to the kid? You know, he's talking about how much he loves his sisters and he loves his mum. So, we very deliberately don't preempt or pre-inform the participants, because we run leadership programs and so on after the original presentation as well to keep a tradition going in each school campus of uplifting each other to good choice. But we don't preempt the students about the content. We'd rather them approach the engagement with an expectation that they're going to get an orthodox driver ed cautionary tale told to them, rather than something that makes them reflect about their feelings about their loved ones and challenges them as a social mission. So we often say to them, don't we, Melissa, you know, you guys do change your world every day. You know, there's plenty of student groups out there that will go as far as gluing their backsides to public streets to rally against climate change, change the Earth's temperature, and rally for diversity and equality and so many noble social causes. And we love the idea that they can roll the protection of their loved ones, their friends, their families, their communities, by preventing totally preventable tragedy in people's lives, in the people they profess to love and they profess to protect. It's so easy to protect them by making good choices as a passenger and as a driver, and by being outspoken about advocating good choices amongst your friendship circles, even if that's only between two people.
Oh yes.
You know, on that, Julia, I was just telling this story. I did my first presentation yesterday. I was in Sydney. So first presentation to schools for 2022. And I was telling the students that there's a very beautiful school in Sydney, from a very affluent area, 300 young year 12 boys coming in to listen to it. I didn't know this at the time. They contacted me afterwards to say that when they found out that they were going to a road safety presentation, they bought in their study books. They sat up the back with all intention to use that hour to catch up on their study.
Yeah.
When I'd concluded that presentation, every single lad, all 300, came up and gave me a hug. And these boys said to me, from the second that you opened your mouth to the end of that presentation, we listened to everything that you had to say. And here we were walking going, ugh, road safety, we're just going to study.
Yes.
That is often the case at every single school that we go to. The feedback is verbatim on that. Because we don't moralise safety, danger, right or wrong. We don't lecture them. We uplift them. We inspire them to protect their loved ones from the wholly preventable misery of youth road trauma. And that's why we're so unique, and we can be that way, because we're not victims, parents. we are perpetrators' parents, so we can just speak to so many harsh things, and we can be harsh on Jordan because he was a perpetrator and we are perpetrators' parents.
Yes.
Yeah, it's funny that teens do not conceive of themselves as victims.
Yes.
So if you lecture them about your concern about them, we don't want you to be a victim. And if you only show them victims, then they tend to be numb to the messages.
Yeah.
But if you show them a family that looks a lot like your family.
Yes.
And if you challenge them to think about their loved ones, then you create an emotional authenticity and you build a bridge with them, you know?
Yeah. Because they can see
them. And then, of course, yeah. And we haven't got all the answers, have we, Melissa, on this? And in 20 years' time, we'll still be learning, no doubt. And in 30 years' time, you know, because the program's got a lot of scalability.
Yes.
But remaining curious and remaining open to each student cohort, each student, actually. We talk about one young person, one friendship cohort, one school, one family, one community at a time. And that's literally how it rolls out, because each student can take personal accountability and personal ownership of the You Choose mission. And in 40 years' time, it's a long arc project. Our dream is that people don't look at each other and say, we've all done it. They don't look at each other and say, endangering other people on the road is a rite of passage.
Right,
it's exactly. It's just part of growing up. It's all part of growing up.
Right.
It's not. It's no more a part of growing up than having to smoke a cigarette because you're 7-8. Nonsense.
Exactly.
Right? It's just a totally misguided paradigm.
No, it's true. It's true.
Mm.
It's on the language too. It's on the language in society. That's why I always say, listen to what we're actually saying. Like someone said to me the other day, well, there's always a first time. I said, no, there isn't, actually. There shouldn't be a first time for smoking crack. You know what it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is there a first time for that? There's certain things there's not a first time for.
Yes. We often say that, isn't it funny that road safety is actually all about love?
Mm. It really is.
It really is. It is all about love.
It's also about the resources and the engineering and the technologies and the driver ed and everything. But we always say this, Julia, and it's not a motherhood statement. It's a statement of fact. The very, very most skillful, highly trained driver can be driving on the best engineered road in the safest car in a jurisdiction with the highest fines, penalties, and most stringent laws and still make choices that kill other people.
Of course.
So, and that's a truth that we gloss over. Mm. And from a societal level, we still invest so much money in the same resources that worked so magnificently back in the 70s and 80s to reduce the road tolls in the Western world. So we still invest in the same style of resources, and we still have to. By the way, this is by no means saying that we don't have to continue to invest in the orthodox resources. But why is it a pattern in the Western world and in all the world actually, that road trauma statistics are not decreasing almost at all significantly? Mm. And all of the statistics that are available in our countries and in others point to the same challenge.
The culture.
Have we accepted as a society that we've done all we can for road trauma and that the people that are dying on the roads right now and the overrepresentation, the continuing overrepresentation of 16 to 25-year-olds in road trauma, have we accepted that that's okay, that we've done as much as we can possibly do? I worry that that's the case. And, of course, you can easily think that we've done everything that we can do until it affects you.
Yeah.
And then you think to yourself, how preventable was all this?
Yeah.
It could all have been prevented. Let's stop being so passive.
Yeah.
You know, let's start being optimistic. And
more and that's why I say be proactive. We have to be proactive, right? We can't just hope isn't a very good strategy. No.
Yeah, and curious. And curious. You mentioned something really valuable earlier on, Julia, about the concept that if we think we've got all the answers because of our successes in the 70s and 80s, we're missing the point. You know, what do we have to do to be agile and flexible about our approach to road safety, you know, in the second decade of the 21st century? Well, the way to do it is not to be 50, 55 years old or 45 years old or 35 years old and prescriptively give all the answers to a new generation of drivers that are millennials. What we need to do is go, right, we know what worked in the past. How do we shape what we know has worked in the past into a contemporary context that will work cooperatively with teen culture as it is now, not as it was in the 70s and 80s?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's just understanding where they are. Actually, this generation here, the younger ones, they're very active. They want to, they want to be a part of saving the world.
Yeah.
You know, like I think my generation went through that in university. Like the world, my generation. But this generation, they started younger. And I think just letting them see, because they're very smart, you know, just letting them having the conversation, you know, and giving them that respect to actually listen to what they're saying and what their challenges are or what they're feeling. Because if you think about it, this world can't be, and it's hard for us. It can't be easy for them to grow up.
Oh no!
They've also got that wonderful platform of social media that we didn't have when we were younger. That can
be a force
radically,
of good.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. There's a passivity to decisions, especially that teenagers make, because we've taught them to be passive about the decisions they make as passengers. Oh well, what can you do? It's a dangerous time to be alive. What can you do?
Right.
You can make a decision not to get into a car with someone who you know is a reckless driver.
Oh, yes.
Right? You can make a decision for yourself to not speed, to not drive impaired. They are decisions you're making. It's not fate. But that passivity and the concept of accidents and bad luck are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
And that's a long arc cultural project, you know. It's exciting, isn't it?
It is.
It's exciting to have this conversation.
It's a lot of work ahead, but we have many rivers to cross. But that, you know, we just have to keep going and keep handing the baton on when it's time to, you know, to give support to others that are doing the same, that have the same cause and the same heart. You know what I mean? Yeah. But Melissa and Peter, just please know that you have friends here in Canada and you have support here, and we will do our best to help you sow your very important seeds here as well.
Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
And likewise.
Thank you so much for being here with us today and helping us to spread empowerment and the idea of owning our own choices. Own your choices, own the outcome.
Julia, we look so forward to presenting in Canada someday, hopefully in person, but for now we'll do it by Zoom, and we look forward to having you there on the screen with us.
I look forward to coming. I look forward to coming and visiting you.
Oh, 100%. You'll be warmly welcome. Thank you, Julia, and thanks to all your listeners too.
Thank you.